Hi, I'm John Kiriakou, and thanks for joining us for another Q&A here on Deep Focus, my favorite segments. I also want to thank you, before I start, I want to thank you for getting us over that 100,000 subscriber milestone. That really means a lot for a bunch of different reasons. So thank you for doing that. The first question I have today is from CBaller77. CBaller77 says, "Hi, John. I understand you believe the CIA should be disbanded. However, if you were appointed CIA director tomorrow and told your one restraint was you could not disband the agency, what internal reforms would you take to improve its efficacy?" Fantastic question. Number one, I would significantly beef up the power, the strength, the manpower, and the authority of the Office of the Inspector General. You have to have an internal watchdog group that actually has teeth and can force changes. Number two, and this is something that I'm working on in the form of an analytic paper for one of the big Washington think tanks, is you've got to be able to prohibit the CIA from weaponizing or politicizing its analysis. I've mentioned a couple of times on podcasts that one of the big changes that was made to CIA analysis during the George W. Bush administration was politicization. And what I mean is the CIA's analysis is always very simple. It's fact and then comment. And the comment is just explaining the who, what, when, where, why, you know, why this is important, the analysis. George W. Bush ordered that the CIA add a third section in everything that CIA analysts wrote. So it was fact, comment, and policy recommendation. That is exactly what the CIA is not supposed to do. It's not up to the CIA to make foreign policy. It's up to the president and the secretary of state to make foreign policy. And so the CIA should never, ever offer an opinion on what the U.S. government should do. The CIA's job is to implement the policy that the president comes up with. So serious inward look at inappropriate behavior, illegality, et cetera, et cetera. And I'll add as an aside, the reason why the Office of the Inspector General was not able to stop the torture program was that the Office of the Inspector General was kept out of the torture program. The Inspector General had no idea that there was a torture program, and then finally was told of such a program in 2005, if you can imagine, fully 3.5 years after this program was implemented. We know that because the 2005 report was declassified in 2009 and released to the public. You can find it online. That's unacceptable. So I would really give OIG teeth if I were to be the CIA director. Good question. Jenny the philosopher says, "I am grateful for your moral courage in exposing the torture program." Thank you, Jenny. "When you were in CIA training, did your instructors tell you that you could report illegal agency activities to the Inspector General? I worked for the Government Accountability Office, GAO, and they taught us that we could go to the IG if management didn't address our report of violations of law, agency protocol, or ethics. Why didn't you report the torture program to the IG? Were you afraid of retaliation?" I actually did go to the IG, and the IG didn't have any idea what I was talking about. And so they dismissed me. I went to the IG on another issue. In 1996, at the very end of my time in Bahrain, the ambassador asked me to be the note taker in a meeting with the foreign minister. This was a normal thing. I did it at least once a month, whether it was the foreign minister, the defense minister, the prime minister, whomever. And at the very, very end of the interview, he said to the minister, he said, "Your Excellency, I have a rather sensitive issue to bring up." And he turned to me and he said, "Please stop taking notes." And he says, "One of my predecessors, Ambassador so-and-so, was here recently as a private citizen. And we understand that he was soliciting secret donations to the Bob Dole for President campaign. This is a serious violation of U.S. campaign finance laws. It's a felony in the United States. And I want to alert you to this and to ask you ensure that nobody gives money to the Dole campaign. And the minister looks at me and he says, "You're not writing." And I said, "No, Excellency, I'm not writing." And he said, "Yes, the ambassador came here and His Highness gave him $50,000 in cash." Okay, that's a felony. Clear cut felony, 5 years in prison, mandatory minimum. So we get in the car to go back to the embassy. And the ambassador says to me, "Listen, that last thing, don't put that in the cable back to state." And I said, "Oh, okay." I mean, he was an ambassador. I was just a 30-year-old nobody, 29 years old, whatever I was. And it bothered me. So my tour ended a few months later. I go back to CIA headquarters after a short R&R. And I kept thinking about this and thinking, this is wrong, wrong, wrong. Why do we have campaign finance laws if we're just going to pretend they don't exist? And so I called the Inspector General's office and I said, "Listen, I have information pertaining to a federal crime and I feel that I need to report it." So they told me, "Sure, come to the office." And I gave them the information. They wrote it down. They called me about 2 weeks later and they said that they had investigated it, that what I had given them was indeed reporting of a felony, and that they had referred it to the Justice Department for prosecution. In the end, the Justice Department didn't prosecute this former ambassador or the Bob Dole campaign. What they did is they threatened the former ambassador and the Bob Dole campaign, and the Dole campaign refunded His Highness's $50,000 donation, which of course had been laundered before making its way to the campaign. This kind of terrible crap goes on every single day in government. But when I went to the Inspector General, and I actually had a good contact in the Inspector General because I knew a woman there who had been inspecting wrongdoing in one of the posts in which I served, and I gave extensive testimony. And I went to her and she's like, "Buddy, I don't know what the heck you're talking about. What torture program? We don't torture. Torture's against the law." And I'm like, "Okay, all right." I left it there. But you're right. At the first sign of trouble, what every government employee should do, no matter where you serve, is go to the Inspector General. Steve Curran, 3007, says, two regiments of the U.S. Army Infantry are preparing for deployment to Minnesota. Troops acclimated to cold weather combat tactics. Is it possible Minnesota is a smokescreen and that their real prep is for Greenland?" Yeah. Can you believe we're even talking about this insanity? Yeah, sure. It's possible. I doubt it. My colleague Ted Rawl and I had a conversation about this just this morning. And I think we're both in agreement that if Donald Trump wanted to take Greenland by force, he could do it in a day without firing a single shot. There are like 500 Danish troops there. That's it. There are, I think, 15 French, 15 German, and the Germans are on their way back to Germany. We just have to land the plane and just say, "Okay, this is ours now." We're recording this on the 21st of January. And about an hour ago, the president addressed the Chiefs of State Summit in Davos, Switzerland. It's not Chiefs of State, it's whatever it is, World Economic Forum. And he specifically said that the United States will not use force in Greenland. He said, "We will have Greenland," meaning we'll buy it. This is a very Trumpian kind of tactic where you threaten to go completely off the rails like a crazy person. You so scare the other side that you force them to the negotiating table, and then you just take what you want. I think that's not going to work this time, because the Germans are against us, the French are against us, the Brits are against us, the European Commission is against us. This would be an attack on a NATO country, which would actually invoke the NATO Charter. What is it, Article 5 or Article 6? I always confuse them. And our NATO allies would be compelled by treaty to take up arms against the United States and to fight us off in Greenland. With all that said, I wouldn't be surprised if we end up with some deal with the Danes to mine Greenland's rare earth metals. I think at the end of the day, that's what this really is about. It's about taking their rare earth metals. As an American, I'm embarrassed by this entire thing, but I think that's the direction that we're heading. Minnesota, I think, is political. There are 10 times more, you know, illegal immigrants in Texas than there are in Minnesota. There are 20 times more in Florida than there are in Minnesota, but Minnesota is a Democratic state. And so I think this is just punishment for Minnesota not going for Donald Trump in the last election. I don't think it's about Greenland. Before we go on to the next question, I want to read an ad to our sponsors, and a big thanks to our sponsors. The Department of Justice launched an investigation recently into the Fed. Everybody knows that. Gold at the same time is surging past $4,500 an ounce. The national debt is up to $38.5 trillion with a T dollars. Meanwhile, the U.S. Treasury still values that gold at $42.22 an ounce. That hasn't changed since the Nixon administration. In 1934, gold revaluation instantly restructured the federal balance sheet. It could happen again, which would create hundreds of billions in instant value. The question isn't whether it's possible. Of course it's possible. It's being discussed right now, and you need to understand what to do when that happens. There's a new report that explores this. Trump's $24,000 panic button, that's what it's called, traces the quiet conversations happening about gold in Washington right now, how a reset might unfold, and what signals to watch. If you've wondered how financial power moves before the public notices, this explains it. Read the report or have a copy sent to you. Call 888-GOLD-053. That's 888-GOLD-053 and ask for your free copy, or go to johnlovesgold.com. Thank you. A question from JRB2280. JRB says, simple question. Did Trump make a deal with China and Russia, giving them Taiwan and Ukraine without U.S. intervention in exchange for Venezuela? Isn't that the $64,000 question? It just came to me. That show is actually before my time as well. The $64,000 question. It sure seems that way. I'm not saying yes. I think probably no. I'm not sure that foreign policy is that far-sighted. But I'll explain to those of our viewers who don't know what we're talking about. It seems that the U.S. snatching Venezuelan President Nicolas Maduro, essentially overthrowing that government and then scaring the new president into doing exactly what we want, all the while re-implementing the Monroe Doctrine from 1820, appears to be a green light to China in Taiwan and a green light to Russia in Ukraine. So we're saying the Western Hemisphere is ours. You guys stay out of it. Is that a secret message to the Chinese and the Russians? Is there a quid pro quo now that we won't defend Taiwan against Chinese attack? We won't further defend Ukraine against Russian attack? It kind of seems that way. Now, if it is, that would mean that Donald Trump understands a multipolar world. I don't think he does understand a multipolar world. And then it would make Greenland inexplicable, because ostensibly Greenland is supposed to be to protect the United States from Russia and China. So I don't know. I'm not going to give him that much credit. I'm going to say that Marco Rubio's foreign policy is rather unsophisticated. It uses an iron fist to get what we want. And I don't think it's that long-term in its outlook. So I'm going to say no. Also, though, a good question. Solia CI5NI says, hi, John. Do you think the CIA has lost more personnel due to resignations, such as highly talented and skilled officers in the field, more than have been recruited within the past couple of years? No. And I'll tell you how I know that. I still have a lot of friends in the CIA. Immediately after 9/11, well, but before 9/11, there were 200 applicants for every one job at the CIA. When I was hired, 200 people were vying for the same job. After 9/11, that became 2,500 people for every one opening. And you're talking about a turnover rate of under 2%. So that has not abated. Friends of mine at the agency tell me that it is still just as difficult to get into the CIA as it was in the immediate aftermath of the 9/11 attacks. There are a lot of people who want to get into the CIA. And just on a personal note, I'm rather tired right now. It's we're filming this at 10:30 in the morning. I was up from 1 to 4 a.m. answering Minect calls. Now, Minect is this app that Patrick Bet David created, where people who have been on his talk show can take questions and give answers for money. If you want to text me a question and I text you an answer, it's $20. If you guys are getting it for free, by the way, don't tell Patrick Bet David. If you want to text me a question and I video you an answer, $50. And if you want to talk to me, $10 a minute. Crazy. So I have people from all around the world who want to talk to me person to person. Some of them are in the Middle East or in East Asia, and the only time they can talk is 1 o'clock to 4 o'clock in the morning. So like an idiot, I set my alarm and I answer these Minect calls. I had three last night altogether, like 1, 1:15 and 2:30. And they all ask me the same question, which is very common. How do I get into the CIA? Well, number one, you're not going to get into the CIA because you're not an American citizen. So sorry. Number two, languages, hard languages. The CIA doesn't care if you took Spanish, French, or German in high school. Nobody cares. Or Italian, in the case of the Newcastle Area School District. They care about Arabic, Farsi, Dari, Pashto, Urdu, Sindhi, Punjabi, Uzbek, Tajik, Korean, Mandarin, and Russian. If you speak one of those languages and you want to work at the CIA, you go to the very front of the line of applicants. Even if you can just say in, you know, Tajik, "Hello, my name is John. My car is red. It has four doors." Front of the line. That's essentially what I tell people. But believe me, there is no shortage of applicants to the CIA. Sick Money 93 says, "What was your motivation for joining the CIA? Was it something you wanted to do as a child or as an adult? What development led you to the opportunity to join?" That's a great question. And it's one actually that I get with some frequency. When I was 9 years old, I told my mom and dad that I wanted to be a spy when I grew up. And they thought that was kind of cute. And for Christmas that year, they bought me a set of walkie-talkies and a little vial of disappearing ink. So I could write letters in the disappearing ink. It would disappear. And then when you would put water on the page, the ink would come back. It was great stuff for a nine-year-old. The walkie-talkies my then seven-year-old brother and I just loved playing with. When I was 16, I remember being in the car with my dad. We were driving down Old Plank Road past Fraser's Pond outside Newcastle, Neshannock Township. And I said, "Dad, I decided that I want to be a spy in the Middle East when I grow up." He's like, "Oh my God, still with the spy stuff? Can't you just be like a dentist or something?" I said, "A dentist? No, I don't want to be a dentist." I said, "I want to go to George Washington University in Washington. They have a degree in Middle Eastern studies." It was one of three schools in all of America, along with Rutgers and Brigham Young, that had a degree in Middle Eastern studies. But it was in the heart of Washington, two blocks from the White House. I said, "I could do an internship on Capitol Hill or at the State Department. And I want to study Islam." they finally just accepted it. My dad actually called the University of Pittsburgh, where he got his PhD, and he got some literature for their Soviet studies program, and he got me an application. I'm like, Dad, I don't care about the Soviet Union, and I don't want to learn how to speak Russian. I want to speak Arabic, and I want to live in the Middle East. And then finally, by the time I was a senior in high school, they accepted the fact that this was not something I was going to grow out of. So I went to GW. I got a degree in Middle Eastern studies. My concentration was in Islamic theology, which I took very seriously, although I'm not a Muslim. And I stayed at GW for grad school and got a degree in legislative affairs with a focus on foreign policy analysis. And then I got recruited by the CIA in graduate school. I'm sure just about all of you know that story. I did it for a couple of very specific reasons. Number one, I wanted to see the world. I really did. And I have. I've been to 72 countries. I'm going to add a couple of new countries this year. But I really wanted to see the world, and I wanted to live in the Middle East, which I have done. I lived in the Middle East for years, and I loved every second of it. I got back from Kuwait last night at 6 o'clock. I freaking love the place. In fact, I was talking to a Kuwaiti friend of mine, and he said, would you consider living in Kuwait? I said, yes. Yes. Like right now. Why? Do you have an opportunity? You want to show me a condo? Because the answer is yes. Anyway, spent the happiest years of my life in the Middle East. So number one, I wanted to see the world. Number two, I come from an immigrant family. All four of my grandparents came from the island of Rhodes, which had been under Ottoman occupation for hundreds of years. And then in the time that they emigrated to the U.S. was under Italian occupation. The Italians kept it until 1947, and that became a part of Greece. So my grandparents were so grateful to this country for the opportunity to become Americans that they instilled in us this belief that we needed to give back, right? Whether it was my parents or my brother and sister and me. And so I only considered public service. I only considered the CIA and the State Department or Capitol Hill. That was it. I had no desire whatsoever to go into private industry, even though I probably would have made tons more money. Public service was that important to us. So yeah, that was it. It was pretty straightforward. Stull2Z709 says, hi, John. Thank you for everything you've done and continue to do. Thank you for that. Every video you make inspires me. This may be a bit of a silly question, but here goes. I am in my mid-20s, in college, scared about the state of the world. I'm with you, buddy. I'm scared about the state of the world, legitimately. What do I need to pay attention to domestically and internationally? How do I decide what is critical to know? Thank you for doing what you do. That's a very tough question and a very good one. Tell you the truth, every question we get here is a good one. The answer is a little bit tough because we're going to have to break things into pieces. Number one, consume all the information that you can possibly consume. Of course, you're going to have to look at mainstream outlets like the Washington Post, the New York Times, CNN, even whatever, Fox, MSNBC, I don't care. You're going to have to know what the mainstream is reporting because it's the mainstream that is reporting what the government is doing, whether or not you agree with the spin. You'll be able to sort of filter the spin the more you consume, the more comfortable you feel with these issues. But to me, the most important thing is while you're consuming this information, be very cognizant of the erosion in civil liberties, civil rights, and human rights. To me, nothing could be more important. I'll tell you what I'm really afraid of. I'm afraid at how Congress has just conceded authority to the executive. I'm even more afraid that the federal courts have upheld the concession of that authority to the executive. We have not had a president as powerful as Donald Trump at least since Franklin Roosevelt was implementing the New Deal. But even then, on foreign policy, Congress was heavily involved. That was the last time Congress declared war, was on December the 8th, 1941, the day after the attack on Pearl Harbor. Congress hasn't declared a single war since. Every president has done this through his executive authority. Well, what really frightens me is, you know, the Democrats went whole hog and charged Donald Trump with dozens and dozens of felonies, including violations of the Espionage Act. And then the Supreme Court said, no sitting president can be charged with a crime, period. That was always just a Justice Department policy. It was a memo written during the Nixon administration. It was never recognized as a law. It's just that nobody challenged it on one side or the other until the Democrats forced Trump's hand and he had to sue in the federal courts to overturn these indictments. And that's exactly what the courts did. It went all the way to the Supreme Court and the Supreme Court won. Now, on the one hand, people are saying, oh, we need to prosecute Biden because of Hunter Biden. Well, guess what? You can't. You can't because Donald Trump ensured through the courts that you can't. So forget about Joe Biden. Joe Biden's history. There's nothing you can do about him. Anyway, this frightens me very much. Greenland frightens me very much because we're talking about essentially an attack on a brotherly NATO country. The continuation of the U.S. government to initiate coups around the world bothers me very much. The way we are in bed and in the nude with the Israeli government bothers me very much, especially since we appear to be the bottom in this relationship. So pay close attention to these developments, to the disintegration of our civil rights, civil liberties, and human rights, to the concession of our foreign policy to another government, and to what appears to be the resurgence of a neoconservative, neoliberal, military-first foreign policy. Thanks for that excellent question. And our final question is from ENFEBBN Flow. Hey, John, do you think that the U.S. and Israel are purposefully causing social unrest in Iran to keep them underdeveloped? Furthermore, is Iran an actual threat to the U.S. and Israel? So the answer to your first question is absolutely yes. In fact, the Israeli media have confirmed that just in the past week. The Israeli media, quoting an Israeli intelligence service source, say that it's the Israeli government that started these demonstrations in Iran through cutouts. The Israelis financed the MEK, for example, the Mujahideen e Khalq, which is like ostensibly communist. It's not really communist. It's not really Islamist. It's more of a cult. It's run by this cult figure named Miriam Rajavi. It was considered to be a terrorist group until I think the Obama administration. And now both the Democrats and the Republicans have jumped in with both feet. Rudy Giuliani represented them in Washington. Hillary Clinton feted them at a big dinner here in Washington. Both parties are just in bed with the Mujahideen al-Khalq. Well, the Mujahideen are financed by the Israeli government, and they were the ones who started these demonstrations. They also took it upon themselves to set fire to 38 fire trucks in some of the big cities around Tehran, so that when they set buildings on fire, you can't put the fires out. And it just makes the situation worse. So yeah, I think the U.S. and Israel are purposefully causing social unrest in Iran, yes. To keep them underdeveloped, yes, especially in the nuclear arena. Now, the CIA has issued two separate national intelligence estimates. I shouldn't say the CIA. The entire U.S. intelligence community has issued two separate NIEs authored by the CIA and concluding that the Iranian government is not pursuing a nuclear weapon. I don't care what Benjamin Netanyahu says. the intelligence has shown, and I mean going back to the 90s, that the Iranian government is not pursuing a nuclear weapon. It's as simple as that. Politically, you can't say that because the Israelis don't want you to say that. And that's why Israel has bombed Iran. They launched what was called the 12-day war. They convinced Donald Trump to bomb Iran. It's all about that nuclear program. So your second question, is Iran an actual threat to the U.S. and Israel? No, it's not. Not only do they not have a nuclear bomb, not only are they not seeking to build a nuclear bomb, even if they had one, they don't have a delivery system. And that's why now the Israelis are demanding that any kind of deal with the Iranians, that presumably would include the U.S. government, must include the abandonment of the Iranian missile program, not the nuclear missile program, any missile. Benjamin Netanyahu says all the time that Iran is an existential threat to Israel. Well, guess what? Israel is an existential threat to Iran. It's Israel that keeps bombing Iran, not the reverse. The Iranians have exhibited what many scholars have called strategic patience. Can you imagine getting bombed by a neighboring country and then doing nothing? And because that neighboring country was mad that you did nothing, they bomb you again, and again you do nothing? When the Iranians finally sent drones to bomb Iran, when the Iranians sent drones to bomb Israel, they actually warned the Israeli government in advance, hey, listen, we're sending drones. We're going to bomb you. But we don't want anybody to get hurt. We just have to do it to save face. They sent like 1,000 drones or whatever it was, 600 drones. 7 of them got through. And I think one person was killed. And then the Israelis, with their hair on fire, say, oh my God, the Iranians attacked us. Now we have to retaliate. No, that's the policy. Well, thank you again for these outstanding questions. If you have additional questions, please put them in the chat. We've only gotten over 100,000 subscribers because of you. So please continue to like, share, subscribe, tell your friends. We really appreciate it. I appreciate it deeply, personally. I'm John Kiriakou. You've been watching Deep Focus. Have a terrific day.